kids. I'd be too busy running around doing shit jobs like this. Kev and Marsha knew that and really tried to make me feel part of their setup. I'd grown up with this fantasy of the perfect family, and as far as I was concerned, Kev had it. The first marriage went a bit dodgy, but this one seemed absolutely right. His job with the DEA was now mostly desk-bound in Washington. He loved it. "More time with the kids, mate," he'd say. "Yeah, so you can be one," I'd reply. Luckily, Marsha was the mature and sensible one. When it came to the family, they complemented each other really well. Their house at Tyson's Corner was a healthy, loving environment, but after 3 or 4 days it would get too much for me and I'd have to move on. They'd make a joke of it. They knew I loved them, but somehow couldn't handle people showing so much affection. I guessed that was why I'd always felt more comfortable with Ewan. We were both from the same job lot. As for Slack Pat, he was completely off the scale. Half the world seemed to be his best friend, and he was still working on the rest. Even when he opened the fridge door and the light came on, he'd have to launch into some sort of chat-up routine. When he started the BG job in Washington, a real estate agent took him out to look at an apartment in Georgetown, by the university. The way he told the story, he saw a building with people coming in and out. "What's that then?" he asked. "One of the best restaurants in Washington," she said. "Half of Congress seems to go there." "Right, I'll take it," he said. The moon was in a new quarter or some shit like that. And I thought for a while that he reckoned he'd turned into Terence Conran. He told me he used to eat there every day and knew every waitress by name. He'd even started going out with one of them. Maybe it was her that got him into drugs. I hadn't seen it myself, but I'd heard he had a problem. It made me feel sad. We'd all seen the results of addiction during our time in Colombia. Pat had called them losers. Now it seemed he was one himself. Hopefully, it was just one of his phases. Chapter 3 The transfer at Heathrow had been easy. The boys didn't get stopped at the security checks. Probably because Special Branch had been informed and the flight to Washington had taken off on time. Now, as we started the approach, I put on my belt, made the seat upright, and looked out of the window at America. The view always made me feel good. There's such a sense of opportunity in space, of all things being possible. And it's contagious. I hoped McGeer and Kerr were going straight to the hotel. I hoped they'd be playing the good tourist boys and wouldn't blow it by not booking in. If I ever lost the target, I'd look in all the places where he might be. His place of work, the pub, where the kids go to school, even the betting shop. I needed to know as much as I could about them, because once you're inside your target's mind, you can second-guess every movement, even understand why they do what they do. Unfortunately, all I knew so far about McGeer and Kerr was that they liked drinking Budweiser and must be gagging for a fag. So I had to start with the hotel. I needed to get forward of them. That shouldn't be a problem, since Club had its own shuttle bus to get us to the terminal ahead of the herd. However, since they'd pre-booked a transfer, I'd need to grab a cab pretty sharpish if I was going to beat them to M Street. I could have booked one of my own when I spoke to Washington Flyer, but I tried to do that in Warsaw once in similar circumstances, only to come out and find the two drivers fighting over who to take first, me or the target. It was the taxi rank for me from then on. I came out of arrival through two large automatic doors and into a horseshoe of waiting relatives and limo drivers holding up name boards, all held back by steel barriers. I carried on through the bustle, turned left and walked down a long ramp into heat and brilliant sunshine. There was a queue at the rank. I did a quick calculation and the number of passengers didn't go into the limited number of cabs. I wandered towards the rear of the rank and waved a $20 bill at one of the drivers. He smiled conspiratorially and hustled me inside. A further $20 soon had me screaming along the Dulles Access Road towards Route 66 and Washington, D.C. The airport and its surroundings reminded me of a high-tech business park with everything green and manicured. There'd even been a lake as we exited the terminal. Suburbia started about 15 miles from the airport, mainly ribbon development on either side of the beltway. Vast estates of very neat wooden and brick houses, many still under construction. We passed a sign for the Tyson's Corner turnoff, and I strained my neck to see if I could see Kev's place. I couldn't. But, as Ewan would have said, executive housing all looks the same. We crossed the Potomac and entered the City of Monuments. The Westin on M Street was a typically upmarket American hotel. Purpose-built, slick and clean, and totally devoid of character. Walking into the lobby, I got my bearings and headed left and up a few stairs to a coffee lounge on a half-landing that overlooked the reception area and the only way in and out. I ordered a double espresso. A couple of refills later, Kerr and McGeer came through the revolving door, looking very relaxed. They went straight to the desk. I put down my coffee, left a $5 bill under the saucer and wandered down. It was just a matter of getting the timing right. There was a bit of a queue at the desk, but the hotel was as efficient as it was soulless, and now had more people behind the reception desk than were waiting to be served. I couldn't hear what McGeer and Kerr were saying, but it was obvious they were checking in. The woman looking after them was tapping a keyboard below desk level. Kerr handed over a credit card for swiping, and now was the time to make my approach. It makes life far easier if you can get the required information this way rather than trying to follow them, and there was no way I was going to risk a compromise by getting in the lift with them. I only hoped they were sharing a room. To the right of them, on the reception desk, was a rack of information cards, advertising everything from restaurants to trolley bus rides. I stood about 2 meters away with my back to them. There was no big flap about this. It was a big, busy hotel, and they weren't looking at me. They were doing their own stuff. I made it obvious I was flicking through the cards and didn't need help. The woman said, "There you are, gentlemen. You're in room 403. If you turn left, just past the pillars, you'll see the elevator. Have a nice day." All I had to do now was listen to their conversations while they were in their room. And to make that happen, I went to the bank of payphones in the lobby and dialed the firm. A woman's voice asked me for my PIN number. 2422. "Go ahead." "I'd like a room, please. The Westin on M Street, Washington, D.C. 401 or 405 or 303 or 503.
"Have you a contact number?"
"No. I'll call back in half an hour's time." They would now telephone the hotel using the name of a front company and request one of the rooms I'd specified. It didn't really matter whether the room was above, beside, or below the targets, as long as we could get in and plant surveillance devices. I went back to the raised lounge area and read a few of the leaflets and cards I'd picked up, all the time watching the exit onto M Street. I ran through a mental checklist of surveillance equipment to ask for. I'd fit the first wave of kit myself. Wall-mounted listening devices, phone line devices, both voice and modem, and cables that fed into the TV in my room to relay pictures. That'd only take me about 3 hours to rig up once the firm had dropped them off. The second wave, once McGeer and Kerr had vacated their room for the day, would be fitted by technicians from the embassy. In their expert hands, a hotel room TV could become a camera, and the telephone a microphone. Half an hour later, I rang the contact number and again gave my PIN number. There was a bit of clicking, and then the strains of a string quartet. About 5 seconds later, the woman came back again.
"You are to lift off and return today. Please acknowledge."
I thought I'd misheard her. There was a conference at the hotel given by the Norwegian Board of Trade, and all the delegates were exiting for coffee. "Can you repeat, please?"
"You are to lift off and return today. Please acknowledge.
Yes, I understand. I am to lift off and return today. The phone went dead. I put the phone down. Strange. There had even been a memo in green ink from the head of the service about this. The fastball job that had now come to a sudden halt. It wasn't unusual to get lifted off, but not so quickly. Maybe Simmons had decided these people weren't that important after all. Then I thought, so what? Who gives a fuck? At the end of the day, they wanted me to do the job, and I've done it. I called the booking agency and tried to get a flight out of Washington. The only one I could get on was the British Airways at 21:35, which was hours away. Kev and Marsha were only an hour down the road towards the airport, so why not? I dialed another number and Kev answered. His voice was wary, then he recognized mine.
Nick, how's it going?
He sounded really happy to hear me. Not too bad. I'm in Washington.
What are you doing?
Nah, I don't want to know. You coming to see us? If you're not busy. I'm leaving tonight, back to the UK. It'll be a quick stop and hello, okay?
Any chance of you getting your arse up here right away? I've just got the ball rolling on something, but I'd be interested to know what you think.
You'll really like this one.
No problem, mate. I'll hire a car at the hotel and head straight over.
Marsha will want to go into Cordon Bleu overdrive. I'll tell her when she gets back with the kids. Have a meal with us, then I'll take you to the airport. You won't believe the stuff I've got here. Your friends over the water are busy.
I can't wait.
Nick, there's one other thing.
What's that, mate?
You owe Aida a birthday present. You forgot again, dickhead. Driving west along the freeway, I kept wondering what Kev could want to talk to me about.
Friends over the water.
Kev had no connection with Pyra that I knew of. He was in the DEA, not the CIA or any anti-terrorist department. Besides, I knew that his job was far more administrative than field work now. I guessed he probably just needed some background information. I thought again about Slack Pat and made a mental note to ask Kev if he had a contact address for the arseless one. I got on the interstate. Tyson's Corner was the junction I had to get off at. Well, not really. I wanted the one before, but I could never remember it. The moment I left the freeway, I could have been in leafy suburban Surrey. Large, detached houses lined the road, and just about every one seemed to have a 7-seater people carrier in the drive and a basketball hoop fixed to the wall. I followed my nose to Kev's estate and turned into their road, Hunting Bear Path. I carried on for about a quarter of a mile until I reached a small parade of shops, arranged in an open square with parking spaces, mainly little delis and boutiques specializing in scented candles and soap. I bought sweets for Ada and Kelly that I knew Marsha wouldn't let them have, and a couple of other presents. Facing the shops was a stretch of waste ground, which looked as if it had been earmarked as the next phase of the development. On and around the churned-up ground were porter cabins, big stockpiles of girders and other building materials, and a couple of bulldozers. Far up on the right-hand side amongst the large detached houses, I could just about make out the rear of Kev's and Marsha's deluxe colonial. As I drove closer, I could see their Daihatsu people carrier, the thing she threw the kids into to go screaming to school. It had a big, furry Garfield stuck to the rear window. I couldn't see Kev's company car, a Caprice classic that bristled with aerials. Such an ugly model only government agents use them. Kev normally kept his in the garage, safely out of sight of predators. I was looking forward to seeing the Browns again, even though I knew that by the end of the day I'd be more exhausted than the kids. I got to the driveway and turned in. There was nobody waiting. The houses were quite a distance apart, so I didn't see any neighbours either. But I wasn't surprised. The commuter belt of Washington is quite dead during work and school days. I braced myself. On past form, I'd get ambushed as soon as the car pulled up. The kids would jump out at me, with Marcia and Kev close behind. I always made it look as if I didn't like it, but actually I did. The kids would know I'd have presents. I'd bought a little Tweety Pie watch for Ida, and Kelly's was a handful of Goosebumps horror books. I wouldn't say anything to Aida about forgetting her birthday. Hopefully she'd have forgotten. I got out of the car and walked towards the front door. Still no ambush. So far so good. The front door was ajar, about 2 inches. I thought, here we go. What they want me to do is walk into the hallway like Inspector Clouseau. And there's going to be a Kato-type ambush. I pushed the door wide open and called out, "Hello? Hello? Anyone home?" Any minute now, the kids would be attacking a leg each. But nothing happened. Maybe they had a new plan and were all squared away somewhere in the house, waiting, trying to stifle their giggles. Once through the front door, there was a little corridor which opened up into a large rectangular hallway, with doors leading off to the different downstairs rooms. In the kitchen to my right, I heard a female voice on the radio singing a station logo. Still no kids. I started tiptoeing towards the noise in the kitchen. In a loud stage whisper, I said, "Well, well, well, I'll have to leave, seeing as nobody's here. What a shame, because I've got 2 presents for 2 little girls. To my left was the door to the lounge, open about a foot or so. I didn't look in as I walked past, but I saw something in my peripheral vision that at first didn't register. Or maybe it did. Maybe my brain processed the information and rejected it as too horrible to be true. It took a second for it to sink in, and when it did, my whole body stiffened. I turned my head, slowly trying to make sense of what was in front of me. It was Kev. He was lying on his side on the floor, and his head had been battered to fuck by a baseball bat. I knew that because I could see it on the floor beside him. It was one he'd shown off to me on my last visit, a nice, light, aluminium one. He'd shaken his head and laughed when he'd said the local rednecks called them Alabama lie detectors. I was still rooted to the spot. I thought, fucking hell. He's dead. Or should be, looking at the state of him. What about Marcia and the kids? Was the killer still in the house? I had to get a weapon. There was nothing I could do for Kev at the moment. I didn't even think about him, just that I needed one of his pistols. I knew where all 5 of them were concealed in the house, always above child level and always loaded and made ready. A magazine on the weapon and a round in the chamber. All Marcia or Kev had to do was pick up one of the weapons and blat anyone who was pissed off with Kev. And there were more than a few of those in the drug community. I thought, fuck. They've got him at last. Very slowly I put the presents on the floor. I wanted to listen for any creaking of floors, any movement at all around the house. The living room was large and rectangular. Against the left-hand gable wall was a fireplace. Either side of it were alcoves with bookshelves, and I knew that on the second shelf up, on the right, was the world's biggest, fattest thesaurus, and on top of that, tucked well back out of view, just above head level, but close enough to reach up for, was a big fat gun. It was lying so that, as you picked it up, it would be in the correct position to fire. I ran. I didn't even look to see if there was anyone else in the room. Without a weapon, it wouldn't have made much difference. I reached the bookcase, put my hand up and took hold of the pistol, spun round and went straight down onto my knees in the aim position. It was a Heckler & Koch USP 9mm, a fantastic weapon. This one even had a laser sight under the barrel. Where the beam hits, so does the round. I took a series of deep breaths. Once I'd calmed myself, I looked down and checked the chamber. I got the top slide and pulled it back a bit. I could see the brass casing in position. Now what was I going to do? I had my car outside. If that got reported and traced, there'd be all kinds of drama.
I was still under my alias cover. If I got discovered, that meant the job got discovered. And then I'd be in a world of shit. I had a quick look at Kev, just in case I could see breathing. No chance. His brains were hanging out. His face was pulped. He was dead. And whoever had done it was so blasé they'd just thrown the baseball bat down and left it there. There was blood all over the glass coffee table and the thick shagpile carpet. Some was even splattered on the patio windows. But strangely, apart from that, there wasn't much sign of a struggle. Chapter 4 I had to make sure Marcia and the kids weren't still here, tied up in another room or held down by some fucker with a gun to their heads. I was going to have to clear the house. If only room clearing was as easy as Don Johnson made it look in Miami Vice. Run up to the door, get right up against the doorframe, jump out into the middle of it, pistol poised, and win the day. A doorway naturally draws fire, and if you stand in one, you're presenting yourself as a target. If there's a boy waiting the other side for you with a shotgun, you're dead. The first room I had to clear was the kitchen. It was the nearest, plus it had sound. I was on the opposite side of the living room to the kitchen door. I started to move along the outside wall of the room. I stepped over Kev, not bothering to look at him. The pistol was out in front of me. It had to be ready to fire as soon as I saw a target. Where your eyes go, the pistol goes. I mentally divided the room into bounds. The first was from the settee halfway across the lounge, a distance of about 20 feet. I got there and went static by a big TV stereo setup, which gave me a bit of cover while I cleared the door that led back to the hallway. It was still open. There was nothing in the hallway. As I moved through, I closed the door behind me. I approached the one to the kitchen. The handle was on the right-hand side and I couldn't see the hinges, so it had to open inwards. I moved across to the hinged side and listened. Just above the sound of my breath and that of my heart thumping, I could hear some bonehead on the radio. "Injured at work? Fight for compensation through our expert attorneys. And remember, no win, no fee." My pistol arm wasn't completely stretched out, but the weapon was still facing forward. I leaned over to the handle, turned it, gave the door a push and moved back. Then I opened it a bit more from the hinge side to see if there was any reaction from inside the kitchen. I could hear more of the radio and also a washing machine, turning, stopping, turning. But nothing happened. With the door now open just a few more inches, I could see into a small part of the kitchen. I moved forward and pushed the doorframe fully open. Still no reaction. Using the doorframe and wall as cover, I edged round slowly. As the angle between me and the frame increased, I gradually saw more of the room. I took my time so I could take in the information in stages. If I had to react, the fact of being 2 yards away from the doorframe would not affect my shooting. And if it did, I shouldn't be in this business anyway. Using my right thumb, I pushed the laser sight button. A small dot of brilliant red light splashed on the kitchen wall. I leaned my body over to present as small a target as possible. If anyone was in the kitchen, all they'd see was a very nervous bit of head. And that would be what they'd have to react to, not the full Don Johnson. The room was like the Marie Celeste. Food was still on the side in the middle of preparation. Kev had said Marcia was going to cook something special. There were vegetables and opened packs of meat. I closed the door behind me. By now the radio was playing some soft rock and the washing machine was on spin. The table was half laid, and that really upset me. Kev and Marcia were very strict on the kids' chores. The sight of the half-laid table made me feel sick inside because it heightened the chances of the kids being either dead or upstairs with some fucker with a 9mm stuck in their mouth. I moved slowly to the other end of the room and locked the door to the garage. I didn't want to clear the bottom of the house only for the boys to come in behind me. I was starting to flap big time. Were Marcia and the kids still in the house, or had they made a run for it? I couldn't just leave. The fuckers who'd done that to Kev would be capable of anything. I was starting to feel my stomach churn. what the fuck was I going to find upstairs? I went out into the hallway again. As I moved, I had my pistol pointing up the stairs, which were now opposite me. The last room uncleared downstairs was Kev's study. I put my ear to the door and listened. I couldn't hear anything. I did the same drill and made entry. It was a small room, just enough space for some filing cabinets, a desk and a chair. Shelves on the wall facing the desk were full of books and photographs of Kev shooting, Kev running, that sort of stuff. Everything was now on the floor. The filing cabinets were opened and paper strewn everywhere. The only thing not ripped apart was Kev's PC. That was lying on its side on the desk, the screen still showing the British Army screensaver I'd sent him for a laugh. The printer and scanner were on the floor beside the desk, but that was where they had always been. I went back out and looked at the stairs. They were going to be a problem. They went up one flight, then turned back on themselves for the second before hitting the landing. That meant that I'd have to be a bit of a Houdini to cover my arse getting up there. I wouldn't use the laser now. I didn't want to announce my movements. I put my foot on the bottom stair and started to move up. Fortunately, Kev's stair carpet was a thick shag pile, which helped keep the noise down, but still it was like treading on ice. Gently testing each step for creaks, always placing my feet to the inside edge, slowly and precisely. Once I got level with the landing, I pointed my pistol up above my head and, using the wall as support, moved up the stairs backwards, step by step. A couple of steps, wait, listen. A couple more steps, wait, listen. There was only one of me, and I had only 13 rounds to play with. Maybe 14, if the round in the chamber was on top of a full magazine. These boys might have semi-automatic weapons for all I knew, or even fully automatic. If they did, and were waiting for me, it would not be a good day out. The washing machine was on its final thundering spin. Still soft rock on the radio. Nothing else. Adrenaline takes over. Despite the air conditioning, I was drenched with sweat. It was starting to get in my eyes. I had to wipe them with my left hand, one eye at a time. The girl's room was facing me. From memory, there were bunk beds and the world's biggest shrine to Pocahontas. T-shirts and posters, bed linen and even a doll whose back you pressed and she sang something about colours. I stopped and prepared myself for the worst. I reached for the handle and started to clear the room. Nothing. No one. For once, the room was even clean and tidy. There were piles of teddies and toys on the beds. The theme was still Pocahontas, but Toy Story was obviously a close second. I gradually came out onto the landing, treating it as if it was a new room because I didn't know what might have gone on in the half minute since I'd left it. I moved slowly down to the next bedroom, with my back nearly touching the wall, pistol forward, eyes watching front and rear, thinking, what if? What do I do if they appear from that doorway? What if? What if? As I got nearer to Kev's and Marsh's room, I could see that the door was slightly ajar. I couldn't actually see anything inside yet, but as I moved nearer, I started to smell something. A faint metallic tang, and I could smell shit as well. I felt sick. I knew that I'd have to go in. As I inched round the doorframe, I got my first glimpse of Marsha. She was kneeling by the bed, her top half spread-eagled on the mattress. The bedspread was covered in blood. I sank to my knees in the hallway. I felt myself going into shock. I couldn't believe this was true. This was not happening to this family. Why kill Marsha? It should have been Kev they were after. All I wanted to do was throw my hand in and sit down and cry. But I knew the kids had been in the house. They might still be here. I got a grip on myself and started to move. I went in, forcing myself to ignore Marsha. The room was clear. The next job was the ensuite bathroom. I made entry, and what I saw made me lose it. Totally fucking lose it. Bang! I went back against the wall and slumped onto the floor. Aida was lying on the floor between the bath and the toilet. Her 5-year-old head had been nearly severed from her shoulders. There was just 3 inches of flesh left intact, and I could see the vertebra still holding on. Blood was everywhere. I got it all over my shirt and hands. I was sitting in a pool of it, soaking the seat of my trousers. Turning my head away and looking out of the ensuite, I could now see more of Marcia. I had to hold back my scream. Her dress was hanging normally, but her tights had been torn, her knickers were pulled down, and she had shat herself, probably at the point of death. All I saw at this distance of about 15 feet away was someone I really cared for, maybe even loved, on her knees, her blood splattered all over the bed. And she'd had the same done to her as Aida. I was taking deep breaths and wiping my eyes. I knew I still had another 2 rooms to clear. Another bathroom and the large annex above the garage. I couldn't give up now because I might land up getting dropped myself. I cleared the other rooms and half-collapsed, half-sat on the landing. I could see my bloody footprints all over the carpet. Stop, calm down, and think. What next? Kelly. Where the fuck was Kelly? Then I remembered the hiding place. Because of the threats to Kev, both kids knew where they had to go and hide in the event of a drama. The thought brought me to my senses. If that was where Kelly was hiding, she was safe for the time being. Better to leave her there while I did the other stuff I had to do. I got up and started to move down the stairs, making sure that as I moved, I had my pistol pointed. As I descended, I could see the blood I had left on the wall and carpet where I'd sat. I was almost willing the attackers to appear. I wanted to see the fuckers. I got a cloth and a bin liner from the kitchen and started to run round the house, wiping door handles and any surfaces where I might have left fingerprints. Then I went over to the patio sliding doors and closed the curtains. I didn't want anybody to discover an alien set of fingerprints before I was well out of it, hopefully on a plane back to London. I took a quick look at Kev and knew I was back in control. He was now just a dead body. I went back upstairs, washed the blood off my hands and face, and got a clean shirt and pair of jeans and trainers from Kev's cupboards. His clothes didn't fit me, but they would do for now. I bundled my own blood-stained stuff into the bin liner that I'd be taking with me. Chapter 5. Kev had shown me the hidey hole, as he called it, built under an open staircase that led up to a little makeshift loft stacked with ladders. If ever Kev or Marcia shouted the word Disneyland, the kids knew they had to go and hide there, and they were not to come out until Daddy or Mummy came and got them. I started making entry into the garage. Pushing the door slightly, I could see the rear of the large metal up-and-over doors to the right. The garage could easily have taken 3 extra vehicles besides Kev's company car. "Fucking thing," I remembered Kev saying. "All the luxury and mod cons of the late 90s in a car that looks like a 60s fridge." The kids' bikes were hanging from frames on the wall, together with all the other clutter that families accumulate in garages. I could see the red laser splash on the far wall. I moved in and cleared through. There was no one here. I went back to the area of the staircase. Chances were she wasn't going to come out unless her mum and dad came for her. But as I moved, I started to call out very gently. "Kelly? It's Nick." "Hello, Kelly. Where are you?" All the time the pistol was pointing forward, ready to take on any threat. Moving slowly towards the boxes, I said, "Oh well, since you're not here, I'll go. But I think I'll have one more look, and I bet you're hiding in the Disneyland place. I'll just have a look. I bet you're in there." There was a pile of large boxes. One had contained a fridge freezer, another a washing machine. Kev had made a sort of cave with them under the staircase and kept a few toys there. I eased the pistol down my waistband. I didn't want her to see a gun.
She'd probably seen and heard enough already. I put my mouth against the little gap between the boxes. "Kelly, it's me, Nick. Don't be scared. I'm going to crawl towards you. You'll see my head in a minute, and I want to see a big smile." I got down on my hands and knees and carried on talking gently as I moved boxes and squeezed through the gap, inching towards the back wall. I wanted to do it nice and slowly. I didn't know how she was going to react. "I'm going to put my head round the corner now, Kelly." I took a deep breath and moved my head round the back of the box, smiling away but ready for the worst. She was there, facing me, eyes wide with terror, sitting curled up in a fetal position, rocking her body backwards and forwards, holding her hands over her ears. "Hello, Kelly," I said very softly. She must have recognized me but didn't reply. She just carried on rocking, staring at me with wide, scared, dark eyes. "Mummy and Daddy can't come and get you out at the moment. But you can come with me. Daddy told me it would be okay. Are you going to come with me, Kelly?" Still no reply. I crawled right into the cave until I was curled up beside her. She'd been crying, and strands of light brown hair were stuck to her face. I tried to move them away from her mouth. Her eyes were red and swollen. "You're in a bit of a mess there," I said. "Do you want me to clean you up? Come on. Let's go and get you sorted out, shall we?" I got hold of her hand and gently guided her out into the garage. She was dressed in jeans, jean shirt, trainers, and a blue nylon puffer jacket. Her hair was straight and just above her shoulders, a bit shorter than I remembered it. And she was quite lanky for a 7-year-old, with long, skinny legs. I picked her up in my arms and held her tight as I carried her into the kitchen. I knew the other doors were closed, so she wouldn't see her dad. I sat her down on a chair at the table. "Mummy and Daddy said they had to go away for a while, but asked me to look after you until they come back, okay?" She was trembling so much I couldn't tell if her head was nodding or shaking. I went to the fridge and opened it, hoping to find some comfort food. 2 large, half-eaten Easter eggs were on the shelf. "Mmm, yum. Do you want some chocolate?" I'd had a good relationship with Kelly. I thought she was a great kid, and that wasn't just because she was my mate's daughter. I smiled warmly, but she stared at the table. I broke off a few pieces and put them on one of the side plates that she'd probably been setting earlier with Aida. I found the off switch on the radio. I'd had enough relaxing soft rock for one day. As I looked at her again, I suddenly realized I'd fucked up. What was I going to do with her? I couldn't just leave her here. Her family were lying dead all over the house. But, more importantly, she knew me. When the police arrived, she'd be able to say, "Nick Stone was here." They'd soon find out that Nick Stone was one of Daddy's mates, and the house was full of photographs with me in them. And if they did arrest the grinning drunk in the barbecue shots, they'd find that, for some strange reason, he wasn't Nick Stone at all. He was Mrs. Stamford's little boy. As they used to say in the harp commercial, time to make a sharp exit. Kev's jacket was hanging over one of the chairs. I said, "Let's wrap you up in your dad's coat. That'll keep you nice and warm." At least she'd have something of her dad's. With luck, it would cheer her up. There was just a little bit of whimpering in reply. She was almost in rigor mortis with shock, though at least she had turned her head to look at me now. This was where normally I would have let Marcia take over, because a child's mind was far too complicated for me to work out. But I couldn't do that today. I wrapped the coat around her and said, "Here you are. Get this around you. Look, it's your dad's. Don't tell him, eh?" I felt something solid in one of the pockets and checked. "Oh, good, look. We can phone him up later." I looked out of the window, no movement. I picked up the bin liner, grabbed Kelly's hand, then realized that to reach the front door, I'd have to come out of the kitchen and into the hallway. "Just sit there a second," I said. "I've got to do something." I had a quick check to make sure the doors were closed.
I thought again about fingerprints, but if I'd missed a set, there was nothing I could do about it now. My only thought was to get out of the area and keep Kelly away from the police until I'd sorted things out. I went back and got her, and checked the front of the house again for movement. She seemed to be finding it hard to walk. I had to grip Kev's coat by the collar and half drag her towards the car. I put her in the front passenger seat and smiled. "There you go. That's nice and warm. Better look after your dad's coat for him. Keep it nice for when you see him." Then I threw the bin liner in the back, settled into the driver's seat, put my seatbelt on and turned the ignition. We drove off at a really sensible pace, nothing outrageous, nothing likely to be noticed. We'd only gone a few hundred yards when I thought of something. I looked across at her and said, "Kelly, put your seatbelt on. Do you know how to do that?" She didn't move, didn't even look at me. I had to do it for her. I tried to make small talk. "It's a nice day today, isn't it?" "Yep, you'll stay with me a while. We'll get everything sorted out." Silence. My mind switched back to the matter in hand. What was I going to do? Whatever I decided, I knew it was no good where we were at the moment. We needed to lose ourselves in a crowd. I headed for Tyson's Corner. I turned to Kelly and smiled, trying to be happy-go-lucky Uncle Nick. But it just wasn't happening. She was staring anxiously out of the window, as if she thought she was being wrenched away from all her familiar landmarks, and seeing them for the last time. "It's okay, Kelly." I tried to stroke her hair. She jerked her head away. "Fuck it. Just let her get on with it. With luck, I'd be able to offload her before too long." I turned my thoughts to Kev. He'd said he had some information about my friends over the water. Could it have been Pyra who'd killed him? What the hell for? It was highly unlikely that they'd start messing about like that. Not in America. They were too switched on to bite the hand that was feeding them. Other things weren't adding up. Why wasn't there a struggle? Both Marcia and Kev knew where the weapons were. Why weren't they used? Why was the front door ajar? There was no way that would have happened. People didn't just wander in off the street into Kev's house. They had to be invited in. I felt a rush of anger. If the family had been killed in a car crash, fair one. If the killers had come in and maybe shot them, I'd be upset, but at the end of the day, if you live by the sword, you must be prepared to die by the sword. But not this way. They'd been hacked about for no reason that I could see. I forced myself to think rationally. There was no way I could phone the police and explain my version. Although I'd been lifted off, I was still operating in another country without its consent. It goes on in the UK too, but getting caught would be a big no-no. The operation here would be seen as a sign of betrayal and would create distrust between the two security communities. There was no way SIS would back me up. That would defeat the whole purpose of deniable ops. I was on my own. Looking at my passenger, I knew I had a problem. As we drove towards Tyson's Corner, I realized what I had to do. I saw a Best Western Hotel on the left and an open-plan mall on the right. I had to dump the car because, if I'd been seen, that was one of the connections between me and the house. I needed somewhere to leave it that wasn't isolated, somewhere without video cameras. As well as the shopping mall and its massive car parks, satelliting it was a drive-through Burger King with its own parking. It's all very well abandoning a vehicle in the middle of hundreds of others in a car park during shopping hours, but at night it might be the only car left there. It's going to stick out and will be checked over by police patrols. What I was after was an area that was really busy day and night. Multi-story car parks were out, because 9 times out of 10 they have video cameras to stop muggings and car theft. Many multi-story car parks have a camera that takes a picture of the number plate and driver as you drive in. At any major junction and along most major thoroughfares, there are traffic video cameras.
If my car had been pinged outside Kev's house, the first thing they'd do was study the traffic videos and car park photography. "Shall we get a burger and some shakes?" I suggested. "Do you like milkshakes? I tell you what, I'll park up, and maybe we'll even go shopping." Again, it would be no good driving into the Burger King car park, stepping out, and then walking a few hundred meters to the shopping mall. That isn't normal behavior. It might register in people's minds and be triggered off at a later date. So I wanted to make the two of us look as natural as possible. "Strawberry or vanilla? Which one do you want?" No reply. "Chocolate? Go on. I'm going to have a chocolate." Nothing. I parked up. The place was pretty full. I cupped my hand under her chin and gently turned her face so that she was looking at my big smile. "Milkshake?" There was a faint movement of her head, or maybe it was a nod of appreciation. Not much, but at least it was a reaction. I carried on with the bullshit. "You just sit here, then. I'll get out, I'll lock the car and go and get the milkshakes. And then, I tell you what, we'll go into the shopping mall. How about that?" She looked away. I carried on as if she'd given me a positive response. I got out of the car and locked her in. I still had the pistol tucked into my waistband, concealed by Kev's jacket. I went into the Burger King, got two different flavoured milkshakes, and came straight back to the car. "Here we go, then. Chocolate or vanilla?" She kept her hands by her sides. "I'll tell you what, I'll have the vanilla. I know you like chocolate." I put the shake in her lap. It was too cold for her legs, and as soon as she lifted it up, I said, "Come on then, let's go to the shops. You can bring that with you." I got her out, closed the door, and locked up. I did nothing about our fingerprints. No matter how hard I tried, I'd never get rid of them all. So what was the point? I opened the boot, pulled out the bag with the bits and pieces I'd bought at Shannon, and threw in the bin liner full of blood-stained clothing. It looked like rain. We walked towards the shopping mall, and I kept on talking to her because the situation felt so awkward. What else do you do, walking along with a kid who doesn't belong to you and doesn't want to be with you? I tried to hold her hand, but she refused. I couldn't make an issue of it with people around, so I gripped the shoulder of the jacket again. There was everything in the shopping centre, from a computer discount warehouse to an army surplus store, all housed in long, one-story purpose-built units that were like islands in a sea of car park. We went into a clothes store, and I bought myself some jeans and another shirt. I'd change as soon as I'd had a shower and got Ada's blood off my back and legs. At an ATM, I drew out $300, the maximum allowed on my credit card. We came back out to the car park, but didn't return to the car. I kept a firm grip on her as we walked towards the hotel across the road. Chapter 6. As we got nearer, I could see that the Best Western was, in fact, separated from the main drag by a row of single-story office buildings. Our view was of the rear of the hotel. Looking each way, it was obvious that the junctions that would lead us round to the front of the hotel were miles away. I decided to take a shortcut. The traffic was busy, and the road system hadn't been designed for people on foot. With the number of lanes and volume of traffic, it was like crossing a motorway in the UK. But at least there were traffic lights slowing the vehicles and creating gaps. I gripped Kelly's hand as we dodged to the central reservation and waited for another gap. I looked up at the sky. It was very overcast. Rain couldn't be far away. Drivers, who had probably never seen pedestrians before, hooted furiously. But we made it to the other side and scrambled over small railings onto the sidewalk. More or less directly in front of us was a gap between two office buildings. We went through and crossed a short stretch of waste ground that brought us into the hotel car park. As we walked past the lines of vehicles, I memorized a sequence of letters and numbers for a Virginia plate. The Best Western was a large four-story rectangle. The architecture very 1980s. Every elevation was concrete and painted a sickly off-yellow. As we walked out of the reception area, I tried to look inside. I didn't want them to see us coming from the direction of the car park, because it would be odd to walk all that way without first checking that they could take us, and then unloading our bags. I hoped Kelly would stay silent when we were inside. I just wanted to do the business and walk out again, as if we were going to see Mummy back in the car. Inside the lobby, I got hold of her and whispered, "You just sit there. I'm going to get us a room." I gave her a tourist freebie that was lying on one of the chairs, but she ignored it. In one corner, by the coffee percolator and cream, was a large TV. A football game was on. I went over to the receptionist, a woman in her mid-40s who thought she was still 24. She was watching the screen and probably fancying her chances with one of the quarterbacks. All smiles, I said, "I need a family room just for one night, please."
"Certainly, sir,"
she said, a graduate with honors from Best Western's charm school.
"If you'd like to fill out this card."
As I started to scribble, I said, "How much is a room, anyway?"
"That's $64 plus tax."
I raised an eyebrow, to make it look as if that was a lot of money to a family man like myself.
"I know," she smiled. "I'm sorry about that."
She took my credit card to swipe, and I filled in the form with crap. I've been doing this for donkey's years, lying on hotel forms, looking relaxed as I wrote, but in fact scanning about 4 questions ahead. I filled in a car reg too, and, for number of occupants, put 2 adults and a child. She handed back my card.
"There you are, Mr. Stamford. It's room 224. Where's your car?"
"Just around the corner." I pointed vaguely to the rear of the hotel.
"Okay, if you park by the stairs where you see the Coke and ice machines, turn left at the top of the stairs and you'll see room 224 on the left-hand side. You have a nice day now."
I could have described the room even before I ran the keycard through the lock and opened the door. A TV, 2 double beds, a couple of chairs and the typical American hotel designer's obsession with dark wood veneers. I wanted to get Kelly settled quickly so I could use the phone. I pressed the remote and flicked through the channels, hoping to find Nickelodeon. Eventually I found some cartoons.
"I remember this one. It's good. Shall we watch it?"
She sat on the bed staring at me. The expression on her face said she didn't like this outing too much. And I could understand that. "Kelly," I said, "I'm going to leave you for just a couple of minutes because I've got to make a phone call. I'll get a drink while I'm out. What would you like? Coke? Mountain Dew? Or do you want some candy?" There was no reaction, so I just carried on. "I'm going to lock the door and you're not to answer it to anybody. Nobody at all, okay? I'll use the key to get back in again. You sit there and enjoy yourself and I'll just be about 5 minutes, okay?" Still, there was no reaction. I hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, made sure I had the door swipe card, and left. I was heading for a call box I'd set in the street because I didn't want her to hear the telephone conversation I was about to have. I didn't know much about kids, but I knew that when I was 7, nothing had gone unnoticed in my house. On the off chance that it wasn't pin-protected, I took Kev's mobile from his jacket pocket. I pressed the power button, and it demanded a PIN number. I tried 2 basic ones, the usual factory default, 4 zeros, and then 1234. Nothing. I couldn't try any more. With some phones, you can only try the wrong PIN 3 times and then it automatically cuts out, and you need to go back to the dealer to get it rectified. I turned off the power and put it back in my pocket. I'd ask Kelly about it later. I turned left via the car park and headed for the call boxes out on the road. I spent a few moments sorting out in my mind what I wanted to say, and then I dialed London. In veiled speech I said, "I've just finished work and I'm in Washington to visit an old friend. I used to work with him 10 years ago. He's now working here for the US government." I outlined the problem and said that Kelly and I both needed help. Veiled speech is not some magical code. All you're trying to do is intimate what is going on, yet at the same time put off a casual listener. You're not going to fool any professional eavesdroppers. That's what codes and one-time pads and all the rest of it are for. But all London needed to know was that I was in the shit. I had Kev's child and needed sorting out. Quick time.
Fine, I'll pass that message on. Have you a contact number?
No, I'll ring you back in an hour.
Okay, goodbye. These women never ceased to amaze me. They never ever got worked up about anything.
It must be hard work being their husbands on a Saturday night. I put down the phone and felt a bit better as I strolled over to a filling station. I knew the firm would work everything out. They might have to call in some big-time favours in the US to detach me from this shit, but what are friends for? They'd pull out all the stops, not so much to get me off the hook, more to make sure their operation was covered up. I was trying to look on the bright side, which was more than the weather was doing. It had been starting to drizzle when I left the hotel, and that had now turned to light rain. With luck, the firm would pick us both up tonight. Kelly would be taken care of, and I would be whisked back to the UK for another interview without coffee and biscuits. I bought some food and drink at the filling station so we could stay in the room and out of the public eye, together with a few other goodies to pass the time, then crossed the road and went back to the hotel. At the drinks machine, I went up the stairs, turned left, and knocked on our door. As I opened it, I said, "I've got loads of stuff. I've got candy, sandwiches, chips, and I've even got you a Goosebumps book to read." I reckoned it was better to buy loads of stuff to keep her mind off things, rather than trying to cuddle or console her. I'd have felt really uncomfortable with that sort of stuff anyway. She was lying on the bed exactly where I'd left her, staring in the direction of the television set, but not really watching. Her eyes glazed over. As I put the stuff down on the other bed, I said, "Right, I reckon what you need now is a nice hot bath. I've even bought some Buzz Lightyear bubbly stuff." It would give her something to do and maybe relax her out of the catatonic state she was in. Apart from that, when I handed her over to the firm, I wanted them to see that I'd made an effort, and that she was all nice and clean. After all, she was my mate's kid. I turned the taps on and called back into the room. "Come on then, get undressed." She didn't reply. I went back into the bedroom, sat at the end of the bed and started undressing her. I thought she might resist, but instead she sat placidly as I pulled off her shirt and vest. "You do your jeans," I said. She was only 7, but I felt awkward about taking those off. "Come on, undo your buttons." In the end, I had to. She was miles away. I carried her into the bathroom. Good old Buzz had done his job and the bubbles were halfway to the ceiling. I tested the water, lifted her into the bath, and she sat down without a word. "There's loads of soap and shampoo," I said. "Do you want me to help you wash your hair?" She sat, stock still in the water. I gave her the soap, which she just stared at. It was nearly time to call London again. At least I wouldn't have to go to a call box for this one. She'd be out of earshot in the bath, just in case I kept the TV on. There was some weird and wonderful cartoon on. 4 characters in jeans, half man, half shark, who said things like "fintastic" and "shark time," and apparently didn't kick ass, they kicked dorsal. The street sharks. The opening credits finished and I dialed London. Straight away I heard, "PIN number, please." I gave it. She went, "One moment." A few seconds later the phone went dead. That was strange. I dialed again, gave my PIN number and again got cut off. What the fuck was going on? I tried to reason with myself, tried to tell myself that this was just a fuck-up. But really, inside, I knew the truth. It had to be deliberate. Either that or maybe, just maybe, the phone line was down. No good thinking about it. Take action. I went into the bathroom, The phone's not working, I said. I'll just go down to the one in the street. Is there anything we need from down the shops? I'll tell you what, we'll go down there later on, the two of us together. Her gaze didn't leave the tiles at the end of the bath. I lifted her out and put a towel around her. You're a big girl now. You can dry yourself. I took the hairbrush from the wash kit and dragged her into the bedroom. Once you've done that, brush your hair. And make sure you're all dry and dressed when I come back. We might have to go somewhere. Don't open the door for anyone, okay? There was no answer. I pulled out the phone line and left. Chapter 7. I was feeling apprehensive as I walked across the car park. I'd done nothing wrong, so why were they cutting me off? Were the firm going to stitch me up? I started to go through all the scenarios in my head. Did they think that I was the killer? Were they cutting away now as a prelude to denying everything? I got to the phone, dialed, and the same thing happened. I slowly put down the receiver. I went and sat down on a low wall that made up part of the entrance to the hotel. I needed to think hard. It didn't take long to decide that there was only one option, and that was to phone the embassy. I'd be breaking every rule in the book. I wouldn't even bother going through all the protocol. I dialed 411 for directory inquiries and got the number. I got straight through.
Hello, British Embassy. How may I help you?
I want to talk to LOSO.
Excuse me?
LOSO, Liaison Officer Special Operations.
I'm sorry, we don't have an extension number for that name.
Get hold of the defense attaché and tell him there's someone on the phone who wants to speak to LOSO. It's really important. I need to speak to him now.
Hold on a moment.
She clicked off and a string quartet took her place. I listened and waited while the phone card was used up. Another woman came on the line.
Hello, how may I help you?
I want to talk to LOSO.
I'm sorry, we have no one of that appointment.
Then put me through to the DA.
Sorry, the defense attaché is not here. Can I help you? Would you like to give me a name and contact number?
I said, listen in. This is the news. I want LOSO or the DA to pass this on. I've tried to phone up on my PIN number. My PIN number's 2422, and I'm getting blanked off. I'm in a really bad situation at the moment, and I need some help. Tell LOSO or the DA that if I don't make contact with London, I'm going to expose what I've got in my security blanket. I will call back in 3 hours' time. The woman said,
excuse me, could you repeat that?
No, you're recording. The message will be understood. All you've got to do is pass that on to the DA or LOSO. I don't give a fuck which one. Tell them I'll call London on the PIN line in 3 hours' time. I put the phone down. The message would get to them. Chances were the DA or LOSO was listening anyway. Some of the operations I'd been on had been so dirty that no one would want them exposed, but that could cut two ways. It also meant that someone like me would be expendable if things weren't working too well. I'd always operated on the basis that if you were involved in deniable operations for the intelligence services and hadn't prepared an out for the day they decided to shaft you, then you deserved everything you got. The head shed knew that Kay's had security blankets, but everybody denied it. The operators denied it. SIS denied it. I'd always been sure that SIS put as much effort into trying to find where the blackmail kit was hidden as they did on the operations themselves. I'd committed myself now. It was a card I could only play once. No way would I be living an easy existence after this. I was finished with the firm and would probably have to spend the rest of my life in a remote mountain village in Sri Lanka, looking over my shoulder. What if the firm decided to admit to the Americans that there'd been an op they'd forgotten to mention? Would they take the rap on the knuckles, then say, "This man killed one of your officers"? No, it didn't work that way. The firm wouldn't know if my blanket was bluff or not, or, if used, how much damage it could do in the hands of the press. They'd have to take it as real. They'd have to help. They had no choice. We'd get lifted by the firm,
I'd be flown back to the UK, and then I'd take up tree-hugging until they forgot about me.
Kelly was lying on the bed with a towel wrapped around her when I got back to the room. The cartoon had finished, and there was some sort of hard-hitting news-type voice on, but I didn't pay much attention to it. I was more interested in getting a response from this little girl. It seemed that I was fast running out of friends, and she might be just 7 years old, but I wanted to feel she was on my side. I said, "We've got to hang around for another hour or two, and then somebody's coming to..." And then it hit me. The no-nonsense female voice was saying, "Brutal murders and a possible kidnap." I switched my attention to the screen. She was black and mid-thirties. Her face was in camera, with Kev's house in the background and the Daihatsu still in the drive. Police were milling around two ambulances with flashing lights. I grabbed the remote and hit the off button. "Kelly, naughty girl," I grinned. "You haven't cleaned your neck. Just you go and get back in the bath right this minute." I nearly threw her into the bathroom. "And don't come out until I tell you to." I hit the on button and kept the volume low. The woman said, "Neighbors report seeing a Caucasian man in his late 30s, around 5'10 to 6 feet tall, medium build, with short brown hair. He arrived at the house in a white Dodge with Virginia registration at approximately 2:45 today. We now have Lieutenant Davis from Fairfax County Police Department." A balding detective was standing beside her.
"We can confirm that there was a man fitting that description, and we're appealing for more witnesses. We need to know the location of the Browns' 7-year-old daughter, Kelly."
A picture came up on the screen of her standing in the garden with Aida, with a spoken description. The broadcast cut back to a studio shot of two presenters saying that the family were victims of what appeared to be drug-related murders. A family portrait appeared on the screen.
"Kevin Brown was a member of the Drug Enforcement Administration."
The anchormen broadened the piece to a discussion about the drug problem in the Washington area. There was no sound of splashing water from the bathroom. Kelly would be out again any time. I started flicking channels. Nothing more on the murders. I switched back to children's TV and went into the bathroom. I hadn't heard any splashing because she wasn't in the bath. She was on the floor under the sink, in the same fetal position I'd found her in at Kev's, hands over her ears to block out the news she'd just heard on the TV. I wanted to pick her up and comfort her. The only thing was, I didn't know how. I decided to appear unaffected by her condition.
"Hello, Kelly," I smiled. "What are you doing down there?"
Her eyes were shut so tight I could see the creases in her face. I picked her up in my arms and started to walk back into the bedroom.
"Hey, you look sleepy. Do you want to watch TV or just go to bed?"
It sounded crap to me, but I just didn't know what to say or do. Best to pretend it hadn't happened. I took off the towel to get her dressed. Her own body heat had dried her by now.
"Come on, let's get some clothes on and your hair combed."
I was really fighting for words. She just sat there. Then, as I started to pull on her vest, she said quietly,
"Mommy and Daddy are dead, aren't they?"
Getting her arms into the vest suddenly became very interesting.
"What makes you say that?"
"I told you, I'm just looking after you for a while."
"So, am I going to see Mommy and Daddy again?"
I didn't have the words to use or the guts to tell her.
"Yes, of course you will. It's just that they had to go away really quickly. I told you it was too late to pick you up, but they asked me to look after you. As soon as they come back, I'll take you to Mommy and Daddy and Ida."
I didn't know it was going to take this long. I thought it was only going to be a couple of hours, but they will be back soon. There was a slight pause as she worked through it all. I got her knickers, placed her feet in them, and pulled them up.